Zika virus is active in more than 20 countries now. It's especially dangerous for pregnant women. Today on Insight, UC Davis's Dr. Dean Blumberg explains what Zika virus is, where it is, and what's important to know about it. Then we're going to talk about zebras and why they have stripes. A team of scientists has been testing that theory that we all believe, that it's all about the camouflage, right? Well, we're going to hear some very interesting results. In this month's Pet Tales, we'll recue our conversation with pet expert Gina Spadafori. She's talking about dental care for pets. And then the music of Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan as Vivian Lee and Cynthia Douglas preview their show Saturday night at the State Theater in Auburn. The show is called Swinging Easy on 52nd Street. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Zika virus is an illness you might be hearing about a lot lately. It was first identified back in the 1950s, in fact, in countries near the equator. But because of an outbreak in 2014 and then again last year, the virus has now spread to at least 24 countries, many of them in Central and South America. Zika virus is especially dangerous for pregnant women and then for the newborn children. There have been a few cases of American women who have become infected while traveling to countries with this virus, but there's a lot to talk about and understand. So, in the studio with me is Dr. Dean Blumberg. He is Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease at UC Davis. Hello. Happy New Year. Glad to have you back in the studio.
Thank you.
What is Zika virus?
So, Zika virus was discovered in the Zika forest in Uganda in 1947, and it was felt to be just the sporadic virus that was causing mild illness in Africa. And then it was discovered in Southeast Asia also in 2007, and then in 2013 in Micronesia, and then it spread to Brazil. It had always been this mild illness until the Brazilian experience, where we've appreciated that it's associated with microcephaly and these congenital malformations of the children. So it's especially dangerous during pregnancy.
Since you just said microcephaly, will you explain that?
So microcephaly is a small head. So you can imagine children who are born with small heads have small brains, and that can lead to all sorts of problems. It can lead to impaired IQ, developmental delays, and in some cases, death.
This is called a, is it flavivirus or flavivirus?
Flavivirus, right.
And so what does that mean?
Well, it's related to other viruses that we're familiar with. In California, of course, we've got West Nile virus, which is a similar virus. But then worldwide, there's also yellow fever and dengue virus.
You're talking about viruses that are spread by mosquitoes, and this one is too. This one in particular by the Asian tiger mosquito.
Right.
Is that the only mosquito that is involved in transmission in the countries where it's active?
There's two main mosquitoes that transmit it, and both of these are of the genus Aedes. So there's Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus. These mosquitoes are generally found in more warm tropical areas. In this country, though, we do have some of these mosquitoes, mostly on the Gulf Coast. And then in California, for years, we've had sporadic sightings of these mosquitoes also. They're different from the typical mosquitoes that we're familiar with that mostly bite at dawn and dusk. These mosquitoes bite during the day, and they're really sneaky. They come up from behind, and they're very aggressive and sort of bite you from behind. So it's kind of a sneak attack. You don't really have a chance to protect yourself.
And as with mosquito involvement, it's the bite of an infected person and then the subsequent bite to another person that is passing the disease.
Exactly. So it's generally not transmitted person to person. You have to have the vector, the mosquito vector, to transmit it from person to person.
There are articles online talking about a very rare case where it was transmitted perhaps by sex or by body fluids. But it seems to be a virus that's still new in what we understand about it.
Right. So it has been detected in semen, and so there has been a report of transmission by sexual contact, but the vast majority of infections are caused by mosquito bites, and there's a large proportion of the world's population that is susceptible to this virus, and that's why it can get introduced into a country like Brazil and other countries, and then it just goes through the population like wildfire.
So I'm looking at a quote from Dr. Lyle Peterson, director of the CDC's Division of Vector-Borne Diseases. And Dr. Peterson says, what we now know is that fetuses can be infected with this virus, which isn't new for infectious diseases, but it's something that wasn't known about this virus before.
Exactly. So there's many viruses that can cause problems during pregnancy. And we're familiar with rubella or German measles, which can cause congenital malformations. So the children can be born with heart disorders or problems with hearing or sight or their brains. And otherwise, it's a mild disease. Cytomegalovirus, herpes viruses can all cause problems during pregnancy, all cause problems with the developing fetus. Zika virus was felt to be this mild disease, and now we know it can act like these other viruses and directly affect the developing fetus. It's been detected in not only the amniotic fluid, the fluid in the birth sac, but also been detected in neurons of the developing fetus also.
That brings me to the cases that at least some officials are aware of in the United States. I've seen three, one in Hawaii, two in Illinois. Maybe there are more. But would you explain the circumstances of these women and their pregnancy and their children?
So these women were pregnant, and then they traveled to endemic areas where Zika virus was being transmitted. They got mosquito bites. They got infected. And then their fetus became infected also. So they didn't acquire infection in the U.S., but they delivered the babies in the U.S.
And were all three babies born with microcephaly?
That's my understanding, is that all three were born with microcephaly, the small heads, yes.
So there's no treatment during pregnancy? There's no treatment in any stage for Zika virus?
There's no known antiviral therapy. There's research being done to look at antiviral therapy, but right now the treatment is just supportive.
And what happens to the mother after the birth, because she's got the illness? And then tell me about the development of children that are born with microcephaly.
Well, there's a wide range of outcomes with the children born with microcephaly. One can be born with a small head and have normal growth, normal development, and a normal outcome. But if it's severe, it can cause severe brain damage and severe developmental delay for these children.
You are listening to Dr. Dean Blumberg. He is Chief of Pediatric Infectious Disease at UC Davis. We are discussing the outbreak of Zika virus. Have you ever heard of a virus like this?
Well, it's similar to rubella or German measles in that it causes a very mild disease among those who are infected. So the disease is fever, joint aches, rash, and then sometimes some eye discharge, some eye irritation. This goes away in a few days. You don't have to be hospitalized for this. You don't die from it. It's not severe. And this is similar to German measles. The problem is, though, it can affect the developing fetus. So we do have some similar models that we're aware of.
It sounds as if it's an illness that if you just happen to get it and you're a healthy adult and it just presents those symptoms, you might not even go to the doctor. So it might not even be diagnosed as Zika virus.
Exactly. And in fact, 80% of the people who get infected have no symptoms whatsoever. So they don't even know that they're infected.
Okay. So that presents a whole other set of difficulties. Let's talk about it specifically in terms of the U.S. There are worldwide health officials saying every country except Canada, perhaps, might be dealing with this at some point or another. And I think that's a weather correlation, isn't it?
Right. So what I've heard is in the Western Hemisphere, every country except Canada and Chile, will likely be infected because of the species of mosquito is likely to be supported by the weather, by the temperature and the humidity. Whereas in Canada, it's too cold, too dry, and same with Chile, that these mosquitoes won't survive.
What are your expectations then about what we may be dealing with here with this virus?
Well, I've heard a whole range of projections, from it's going to spread through everywhere and be a big deal to it's probably not going to be a big deal. I suspect that in this country, it's mostly going to remain a travel-related infection. And that's because we've had these mosquitoes in this country, in the Gulf Coast, and sporadically in California for years, And the same concerns were raised with, for example, dengue virus and yellow fever. And yet we've had very little transmission of those diseases in the U.S. I think one of the reasons is in the U.S., the standard of living is higher. Public health infrastructure is better. We have aggressive mosquito abatement programs, so the pressure of the vector is much less. So the likelihood of transmission becomes less.
There are travel advisories that have been issued by the CDC. I would imagine you would recommend the same thing to your patients. Some countries, though, have gone so far as to say that women should delay their pregnancies for up to 2 years. What about a position as strong as that?
Well, you can imagine that every mother wants the best for their child. And when something is going to affect the developing brain, that's really scary. So it is out of an abundance of caution that those recommendations are being made. I don't think people are going to stop getting pregnant. But if you have the resources, if you have the option to not be in one of those countries, so in the U.S., it means not to travel to one of those countries, if one is pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, then it just makes sense that to have the best outcome for your unborn child that you wouldn't travel and face that danger.
In the midst of a pregnancy, what kind of possible diagnoses are, I'd say within the U.S., do we have at our hands?
So the CDC in the past week or so has come out with some excellent practical recommendations in that regard for that if somebody is pregnant, if they have been exposed to an area where Zika virus is endemic or they know they've even had Zika virus, they have some specific recommendations for testing. There are PCR tests that are available. These are tests to detect the DNA of the virus in the amniotic fluid or in the child. There's antibody tests that test past exposure or infection with the virus. Those are a little bit trickier, but the CDC has some ways for quality control to make sure that those are accurate also. And then there's other tests to look for outcomes in the child. So maybe recommendations for additional ultrasounds for the child who's born with a small head, maybe ultrasounds of that child and extra testing, close neurodevelopmental follow-up of the child, as well as looking to see if hearing and sight might be affected.
So what are your recommendations to people right now? Let's talk about Northern California, Western Nevada, and then beyond.
I wouldn't do anything different if one is staying locally. I think the chances of transmission are exceedingly small. They're not zero. Can't guarantee that it's going to be zero, but it's exceedingly small based on our experience with other viruses transmitted by these mosquito species. So I think that people should take normal mosquito precautions because there are other diseases that you can get from mosquitoes, like West Nile virus, for example.
That's a good point. In light of that recommendation about delaying a pregnancy for 2 years, and again, that didn't come out of the United States. That came from other countries dealing with much more prevalence of Zika virus. But that 2-year timetable, are they estimating that in that time frame we might develop some sort of treatment or vaccine?
Yeah, that estimate is based on thinking that everybody in the population is going to become infected within a couple years. So everybody's going to be immune. And then if you're immune, there won't be a problem. So I don't know if that's going to pan out, that 2-year timetable. It's hard to predict those things.
Other than someone like me or our team calling you, the media wanting to know more about this, are you getting questions about this virus from your patients?
Oh, yeah. I've had several questions from mothers, mothers who are thinking about becoming pregnant or who are pregnant and have traveled to these endemic areas. And you have to realize that the risk isn't always the same. So every case needs to be taken on a case-by-case basis. So, for example, if one has traveled to Northeast Brazil, where we know there's a huge number of cases that are occurring, there's a risk there. If one has gone to the usual tourist itinerary in Mexico, for example, there haven't been cases reported from the usual tourist itineraries. There's just been a handful of cases reported from Mexico. And so the risk there is much smaller.
All right. So it's good advice again to talk to your doctor. We'll post some extra information, links to it on our website. But again, there's a lot of information out there right now, and people can do a lot of research.
Yes, there is.
Thank you, Dr. Blumberg. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Dean Blumberg from UC Davis. And links to that information will be at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A zebra looks like a cross between a horse and a donkey, right? But those distinctive black and white stripes say, I'm not a horse, I'm not a donkey, I'm definitely a zebra. And weren't we taught that those stripes are camouflage for the zebra? Well, scientists from University of California, Davis, and the University of Calgary studied that hypothesis about camouflaging, and their findings were published last Friday in the journal PLOS ONE. Today, we're joined by one of the lead researchers. He is Tim Caro, who is a professor of wildlife biology at UC Davis, but he is also a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin, so we're actually catching up with him from Germany. Hi, Tim. Good to have you with us on Insight.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Is a zebra a genetic hybrid of the horse and the donkey? Let's begin there.
No, it's a distinct species of its own. There are actually three species of zebra or zebra, depending where you come from. And there are four species of unstriped equids or horses that live in the wild. And so one of the things that biologists have been discussing actually for over a century, starting with Darwin and Wallace, was why zebras have stripes. And the first hypothesis that was really put on the table back at the end of the 1800s was camouflage, and we decided that we wanted to try and test that systematically.
That hypothesis... That must have been quite believed because so many of us were taught about it in our science classes.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that we believe it because we see black and white stripes as being so obvious and contrasting. But the problem is that we have so much better eyes than most of the mammals. It's really the primates from the old world that can see in color, and most of the other mammals can only see in what we can think of as black and white. And so we wanted to see whether the main predators of zebras, notably lions and hyenas, would be able to see these black and white stripes just as we can. And so the way we did that is to try and model how these predators would see stripes. So we had to know something about the structure of the eye of these animals, the size of it, and how many rods and cones there are in it. And then we had to know how wide the black and white stripes were on the different species of zebras. And we could put all that into a model and then work out at the distances at which these predators could observe black and white stripes. And the findings were really quite surprising. These predators are really have bad eyesight, and so they're able to only see the difference between black and white stripes at very close distances, say about 20 meters away. So we can see these zebras so much better than can these large predators. And so that makes us think that perhaps these black and white stripes are really not being used for camouflage in any way, because they wouldn't actually have any effect on camouflaging the zebra until the zebra was really close to these dangerous predators, probably close enough whereby the predators could smell or hear the zebras anyway. And so I think that the work that we did with people from Japan and Canada is pretty much kills the idea of zebras being camouflaged against large predators.
It sounds that you worked with a number of calculations. You used digital images and color filters. It was actually, it seems, a rather high-tech and interesting sort of study. Did you do any work in the field to test this?
Well, we had to take pictures of wild zebras in the field because we had to get the right lighting conditions. So the light that we get in Northern California and the light that we get in Africa is not the same sort of light. It's much brighter in Africa. And in addition, we wanted to take photographs at midday and at dusk and dawn when these predators hunt. So we had to take a whole series of carefully calibrated photos in the field and then bring them back to Canada and analyze them in a sophisticated fashion, as you just said.
So again, the results provide no support for the idea that the zebra stripes are camouflaging the zebra from predators.
Yes, and it's not that surprising in that it's a really rather extraordinary hypothesis in the first place, because we have such striking black and white stripes that we can see so easily. It's a bit of a stretch of the imagination to think that that's some form of camouflage. So the results for us weren't that surprising. And in fact, in a study that I did last year, or actually 2014, where we compared a whole bunch of hypotheses about zebra striping together, the one that really came out loud and clear was the fact that stripes on the different species of zebras are found just where we get biting fly annoyance. And by biting flies, I mean horse flies, deer flies, and to some extent, tsetse flies. And we know from certainly a number of different laboratories that these flies don't like landing on black and white striped surfaces. So putting those experiments together with the finding that we see striping where there's high numbers of biting flies in Africa makes us think that the reason that zebras have black and white stripes is to make sure that they're not bitten by biting flies.
So not the hyena or the lion as a predator, but the stripes are to ward off flies. Imagine that.
That's right. And we still don't quite know why that is. We think that probably these flies carry lethal diseases for zebras. They certainly do for horses. And so the zebra species can't afford to be bitten. And so they've evolved an anti-predator defense in the form of these black and white stripes. But the predator is not hyenas, as you say. It's small biting flies.
You're listening to UC Davis Wildlife Biology Professor Tim Caro. He's discussing what was a collaborative study on zebras and their stripes. And the work is ongoing, I understand. Professor Caro, what questions are you exploring next?
Well, we don't know why these stripes are so difficult for the biting flies to land on. And so we have to start work now with people who work on visual physiology of insects to try and work out what makes it so difficult for these flies either to see black and white stripes or to land on them properly. But certainly the defense seems to work well. And so now we've got to really get into the brain of these flies and understand what's going on. And in addition, we've got to work out what's so terrible about being bitten by biting flies for a zebra. Is it blood loss, or is it these horrible diseases that they carry in Africa?
I believe that you said that the camouflage hypothesis dated back to the 1800s, and obviously no one tested it between then and now. Why was that, and how did your team decide to focus on zebra stripes?
Well, I've been working on zebra stripes for a decade now, and it seemed like a good idea to get together with people who really understand animal vision and who have the sophisticated tools to be able to model how other animals see the world. Certainly, we shouldn't be thinking about animal coloration through our own eyes. We should be seeing the colors that animals wear through the eyes of their predators or other members of their species or their parasites. And I think that that's the way the field has developed very rapidly over the last 10 years. We're no longer thinking about looking at animals through human eyes, but we're looking at animals through other species' eyes.
Hmm. I have been told, Professor Caro, that stripes are indicative of a zebra's gender, that the wide black stripe, as opposed to those that have an additional narrow stripe in between, can help you know whether a zebra is a male or female, which is difficult to be able to tell otherwise. Is that true?
I'm afraid it's not true. There's really very little difference between the striping patterns of male and female zebras. It's a nice idea, but not when you look hard and take thousands of photos of them can you find any difference in striping.
Well, zebras are such a stunning animal, and we thought we knew so much. You're making me realize that we knew very little. In terms of defenses then against predator, what about the zebra helps it hold its own out in the wild?
Well, I think that they're very vigilant, and they're able to see predators from some long distance away. They don't defend themselves very well. Sometimes the stallion will defend other members of his harem, but it's not that often. Really, they're actually taken by these predators in large numbers in the national parks that they still live in. But the reason that I was really interested in this is it not only tells us something about evolution and the processes of how evolution works, but I also think that if we can try and make the stories more interesting about these large mammals, they're the colors that we learn about mammals when we're at school or even in kindergarten. If we can make the story more nuanced and interesting, it'll hopefully turn children on to the idea that nature's worth looking at and preserving in the long term.
And it does take a while to change the teaching, so I wonder if it will be my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren who will know that the stripes on a zebra are because of biting flies.
Well, we'll try and get the word out as quickly as we can.
There you go. Professor Caro, thank you so much. It's been very interesting to speak with you.
Thank you.
And when you're back in the United States, you can come visit us when you're back at UC Davis. Thank you. That is Professor Tim Caro, Professor of Wildlife Biology at the University of California. We have posted more information about zebras and their stripes, including the study that was published last week, at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Here's Steve Milne with more news. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. A legislative committee is looking for answers on the status of California's $68 billion high-speed rail project. The rail project's CEO, the chairman of its board, and the leader of an oversight commission are expected to testify to a panel of assembly lawmakers today. Construction of the bullet train has been plagued by delays in acquiring needed land in the Central Valley. Lawmakers also question whether its cost projections are still accurate. The Sacramento City Treasurer says a lawsuit filed against the city and the Sacramento Kings caused a delay in the bond buying process for the downtown arena. That delay will cost the city $27 million over the next 30 years. Treasurer Russ Fair told the city council last night he was prepared to buy bonds for the arena project last May, but litigation delayed entry into the bond market until September. The lawsuit alleged the city promised financial benefits to the Kings that were not made public. A judge ruled against the suit. Nevada unemployment rates are dropping. State data show the rate dropped to 5.5% in the Reno area, down from 5.7% a month earlier. It also ticked down to 6.7% in Carson City in December. That was a drop from 6.8% in November. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Beth.
Pet expert Gina Spadafore usually joins us for Pet Tales. She was not available today, so we're dipping into the archives for this past conversation about dental care. Gina and I talked about some of the controversy over teeth cleaning and how important it is overall to protect your pet's teeth. Here's Gina.
When people of a certain age, say anybody over 40, say when we had pets as children, we never brushed teeth. We
right.
never worried about their teeth. And we thought that dog breath was normal, that horrible smell that our dogs got, especially as they got older. Cats, too. But I think doggy breath is the term everybody knows. And we thought that was normal. And we looked at the teeth and we looked at they were covered with tartar and maybe they were red and they were nasty looking. But we figured that was a natural part of aging for dogs. dogs and cats. And veterinarians have for the last 20 years or so said, no, it's not. Bad teeth in pets, as in humans, leads to periodontal disease. It shortens your life because the bacteria in those mouths is constantly showering the heart, the internal organs, so your body is constantly fighting against those infections in your mouth. And they're painful for pets. As you can imagine, a broken, rotting tooth or inflamed gums would be for you. Mm-hmm. You know what that feels like? If we have a toothache, we're on the phone with our our dentist over the weekend. And yet we let pets sit with rotting teeth in their mouth and don't think anything of it because we just didn't used to think anything of it.
What's the recommendation then now in dental
well,
care?
The recommendation in veterinary dentistry has been the same in human dentistry for years and years, and that is regular checkups and cleanings under anesthesia. You know, we can't do that. Humans can sit there in a chair and just put up with it.
Yeah.
We may not like our dental. Well, I love my dental hygienist, actually, but we may not like the cleaning. It sometimes hurts. But pets won't sit still for it, so it has to be done under anesthesia. But if we can back up a little bit to the prevention is brushing. And whenever you say to someone, still, brushing teeth, they think you're kidding. A lot of people just think, yeah, that's not going to happen, especially the idea of brushing your cat's teeth. Can you imagine?
No,
yeah,
I can't.
No.
And James owns a cat, and I'm seeing him shake his head. No way.
Yeah, no way. And in fact, I don't brush my cat's teeth because I have a cat named T-Bock, the big orange kitty, and he just had his dental done along with my other cat. They just had their dentistries done under anesthesia. But I don't brush him because there are not enough bandages in the world to get through that. Now, if I'd start as a kitten with it, it would have been fine. But I'm afraid I have to admit I was a bad pet owner. I did not start introducing the idea of brushing with my cats as a kitten. My dogs are a little bit more, they're more adaptive. And that they're fine, especially the small one who needs the dental care the most.
So I take my dogs to a groomer, a chain store groomer, and always the option to brush the teeth is there. So I always say yes, and they kindly give me the toothbrush at the end. I also grew up thinking that a rawhide bone or a chew bone cleaned the teeth. What about those two options?
What the groomers are doing, and that's non-anesthetic dental cleaning, that's a cosmetic procedure. Now, they cannot get to the tartar below the root line. They can't do a veterinary examination of problems. They can't diagnose problems. What they can do is clean the tartar from the teeth, and that helps some, but it's not a substitute for veterinary care by any means.
But it is helpful when you talk about prevention. It is a piece of it, yes or no?
It possibly,
I guess I want to know if it's worthwhile money to spend, Gina.
Possibly. And this is where the controversy comes in. The veterinary dentists believe that when you are trying to scrape tartar from a pet that is moving, that you will scrape the tooth enamel, which will allow a home for the bacteria and a faster growth of the tartar. So that is a controversy. The veterinarians say no, the cosmetic, it's only cosmetic and in fact can end up in the long run hurting more than it helps. And of course, the groomers and the people who do it feel otherwise. I don't believe in the cosmetic. I go to my veterinarian once a year for a complete dental examination and cleanings under anesthesia as needed, which I don't need as much because I do the prevention.
You're listening to pet expert Gina Spadafori. We're talking about dental care in this month's Pet Tales. A dog or a cat under anesthesia getting a pet cleaning, a dental cleaning, is going to be costly.
It is going to be costly, and it's interesting. I just had both of my cats' dentals done. And in recent years, along with wellness care, you've seen wellness plans come into veterinarians.
Insurance plans.
These are actually payment plans. You pay once a month for a year's worth of care, and they can be packages that include your dentistry, your exams, your vaccines, and they are then divided into a monthly payment that, like Netflix, comes off your credit card every month. And I actually, for the first time, opted for that with my two cats. And so I had two dentistries done for 1/12 of the cost of them broken out. So I had, you know, several hundred dollars worth of work done, of which I paid a very small amount, and it'll just come off my card every month, and I can budget for it easily. So that is one option more veterinarians are offering. The other thing is, if you're a sensible, good planner like I am not, you will put aside the money every month to pay for it. But in the same way that so many of us have these plans, it's that Netflix, you know, all these monthly payment plans, it's you can just work it out with your vet if they have these wellness plans in place, and that's a good way to do it.
Because it's anesthesia, our vet has been good about recommending if we're going to have some procedure or some blood work or something done, why don't we layer the dental care on top of it?
Oh, absolutely.
But that's kind of luck. You don't plan that.
Well, if you plan that you might have a dentistry as part of your annual examination, and veterinarians are very, very much aware of cost, they are well aware that people have a hard time with the payments. So they make every opportunity to bundle services, to plan, as you said, to get the pre-anesthetic blood work done for another purpose and double back on it. These things are... I've seen lightning changes in the last 3 or 4 years, probably because of the recession, of the way that veterinarians are very creatively trying to find ways to bring their costs down for their customers.
I think it might be helpful if you get specific about dollars for these cleanings, and it can vary from vet to vet and from a dog to a cat, but give me a ballpark.
Okay, it varies widely. I work for Veterinary Pet Insurance now as a veterinary writer, and I asked them to pull the numbers. Now, these are nationwide stats, and they will vary widely depending on various veterinarians, and some regions are more costly than others. But we had a cost for cleanings of $170, which is probably, that's a national average, probably low for California, but the cost of caring for pets with dental disease at $221. So California conditions, I would say you're probably doubling that. So you're talking about $300-$400 for cleaning, depending. It's going to be very variable depending on the vet, the age of the animal, the problems. But if there are actual have to go in and fix things later, that's going to be much, much more expensive.
So you focused on brushing as mm-hmm. prevention. Is there anything else?
Yes, there are actually three things you can do. Brushing is great. And if you can do that, and you start, especially if you start young with your pets, it's pretty easy. Mm-hmm. You can also ask your veterinarian for medicated rinses, things that you put in the drinking water that help to prevent. They can't completely prevent tartar buildup, but they can be put in the water. And of course, you asked about rawhide chews. Rawhide and other chews, you want soft chews the hard chews can break teeth. So you don't want anything hard, but you can get chews that are approved by veterinary dentists to be helpful in removing tartar. There are also foods that are chewier. Those are available from the veterinarians mm-hmm. that scrape the teeth, especially for cats. I know that one of the companies has one that's called a tartar diet, and it's got an abrasive quality to it. So when a cat bites through it, it sort of scrapes the teeth. So again, veterinarians are extremely willing and very able to work with your budget. So if you ask them for these options and ask for recommendations, they'll give you a list to take to your pet supply retailer and find these products.
Okay, and signs to be concerned about. When are there gum problems that mean go to the vet?
If you look at your pet's mouth and you see tartar buildup into the gum line, redness, infection, if you see that your pet is not eating well or is drooling, and also signs that they are in pain. That might be mouth pain, and then you're going to have to go in and have some dental work done because, boy, nothing hurts worse than a broken tooth, and you just don't want a pet to go through that, especially as they're getting older and not eating as well anyway. With the cats, they can certainly hide their signs of illness, but their mouth pain. So just take a look along the gum lines for the broken teeth is obviously... You know, but also heavy tartar buildup and redness around the gum line. You need to see your vet.
Lots of good information there. That was pet expert Gina Spadafore, a conversation that dated back to February 2014. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Still ahead, jazz vocalist Vivian Lee and Cynthia Douglas. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Saturday night at the State Theater in Auburn, the music of Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan, celebrated by Vivian Lee and Cynthia Douglas. Their show is titled Swinging Easy on 52nd Street. They have been swinging with this music for many, many years. Vivian, Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Wow, you almost sang that in unison. So 52nd Street was very snowy this week. You probably saw pictures of it.
Yes.
But we're talking about 52nd Street in Manhattan long, long ago. Will you take me back to the scene and tell me what the street was like then, Vivian?
Well, they say that there were tons of jazz clubs, and all of the musicians back then, they were playing in shows, like on Broadway and everything. And then they would come to 52nd Street, and that's where they got to just have fun and play what they wanted to play and just be with other musicians that were like them. They'd come and support the ones that were already playing there. They'd sit in. They'd have late night sessions. And it was like it was their home, the place where they could go and do what they wanted to do.
Little less than a 2-mile stretch. And it was known as the center of jazz. And we're talking just after Prohibition, the 1930s through the 1950s. So, Cynthia, your background is in Motown music and Motown singing. And blend that with the jazz of this era. Did that inspire you? Are you connected to
it? Music. Growing up in Detroit, I was around a lot of music, all kinds of music, lots of Motown, but my dad loved jazz. So every Sunday after church, he played jazz, and he would give me a little test. Who's this playing? Who's that singing? And I had to be able to say who that was. So it really helped me develop my ear and helped me develop a love for music, all kinds of music, and how it all works together.
Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan, Vivian, you've been working with the voice, in particular, the music of Carmen McRae for years and years. And a lot of people attended your shows at the Clarion Hotel until I asked you, when did it stop? And just in 2014.
Yes, right? August of 2014.
So when you invoke the music, you have to invoke the personality and the spirit.
Yes and no.
Okay. It's
what comes in my heart. I listen to their music. And that's how I learn the songs. I listen to some of their inflections and some of the emphasis that they put. But then I listen to the music itself, and I find my place in the music and what it means to me. And so whatever the lyrics are meaning to me, that's what I do.
Let's listen to a little bit first of Carmen McRae and then Vivian Lee. So here first is a little bit of a very beloved song by Carmen McRae, The Very Thought of You.
The very thought of you.
And I forget to do
the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do.
What's the magic? Cynthia, what is the magic we're hearing?
Oh, I think the magic is the music. Jazz is so magical. It really makes you slow everything down, get into the moment. It really can create a mood. And the beauty of it is that the artists get to perform that music, how it impacts them.
And so that sets up very nicely that we're going to listen to Vivian singing Afternoon in Paris. So we'll talk about it afterwards. Here's Vivian Lee.
An afternoon in Paris is where I want to be. An afternoon in Paris is days for you and me. We sit in a sidewalk cafe, watching people all day. It's springtime in Paris, people run from here to there. It's April in Paris, there's such wonder in the air. We take in a trip down the scene, it's a moment serene. On the Champs-Élysées, the mood is light and gay. On the left bank, the music is playing, soaking. The day ends in Paris, we sit there at the bar.
That's Vivian Lee. She and Cynthia Douglas will perform the music of Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan in one show Saturday night, 7:30 at the Auburn State Theater. The show is called Swinging Easy on 52nd Street. When you hear your music with Carmen McRae's music, tell me about the what resonates not only in your soul but in your head in thinking about the performances of that era.
They swung, and they were having so much fun creating, and that's what we do. We have fun. We have fun with the guys that are playing with us. Mm-hmm. We listen, and whatever is coming from them, if they're really giving a little edge to the swing, then I can hear it, and I slide over to where they are and hang out and swing right in that little pocket with them. And then I might change up a little something and they'll follow me.
And that's the beauty of jazz. You get to do that. It's improvisational. You get to go with the flow. Very often, seldom will I sing the song exactly the same way every time. And you'll find that most jazz artists, they don't play it the same every time. It's just, it's a feeling and a mood and an inspiration that you get from the music that takes you on a journey and you want to ride.
Kind of whatever you feel like you want to say that night.
Say it through music. Let's do the same thing we just did with Vivian with you, Cynthia. So okay. Here's a little bit from Sarah Vaughan. The song is September in the Rain.
The leaves of brown came tumbling down. Remember in September in the rain. The sun went out just like a dying ember. That September in the rain.
Okay, I want to make sure we get to Cynthia's song, which is Rio de Janeiro Blues. And of course, there's a vinyl difference in the recording
yes.
that we're hearing. But here's Cynthia Douglas.
The clouds come up creeping and you got me weeping this morning.
There's the music, but there was a great friendship between Carmen McRae and Sarah Vaughan, wasn't there?
There was, yes.
So do you play with that in the show as well?
We do. We do. We talk about that. Mm-hmm. Because what people are going to get that night is not just one song after the other after the other. We're going to tell you a little bit of the history and give you a little bit of insight into who these two women were, their mm-hmm. personalities, and as well as their music. So it's not just you sit back and you just hear one song right after the other. We're going to tell you a little bit about them.
Right. Hopefully, we're going to take you on that musical journey. So when you leave, you'll have some special moments that you've received throughout the show. You will have learned something about these two artists that you had no idea, that you didn't know before. And I think that that makes the evening memorable. And that's our goal, to make it fun and memorable for everyone that attends.
I'll let everybody know that, Cynthia, you are, in fact, a former Motown backup vocalist and a 2005 Black Music Association of America Best Jazz Vocalist. Mm-hmm. And Vivian is the winner of a Sammy Award for Best Jazz Band back in 2007, but in 2014, also a Black Music Association Award winner for American Best Jazz Vocalist. Your band, do you want to mention your band members quickly?
Oh, yes. We have a wonderful pianist, Brendan Lowe. He graduated from, I think, the Berklee School of Music.
Yes.
And he's originally from Boston. And he is our pianist that night. Rob Lemus, who's a local guy here in Sacramento and a fabulous bass player. He's on bass with us. And a gentleman named Kit Bailey is going to be on drums. And originally, it was Jeff Miniweather, who's our go-to drummer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he has to go out of town for a family emergency. So we brought on Kit, and we're looking forward to playing with him.
Well, good luck with the show. I'm going to close out so we can hear a few more seconds of music. Cynthia, it was great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much for having
Vivian,
me.
Vivian, glad to have you here,
Thank
too.
You.
Come back anytime, and good luck Saturday night.
Thanks so much.
Cynthia Douglas and Vivian Lee. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.